Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Good evening or good morning to the August edition of The Three Horsemen. We have, as announced, recently recast ourselves both as a crafting podcast and a podcast dedicated to Jose Luis Borges. And as such, I would like to welcome our very special guest this evening after I first introduce my two co-hosts, Mr. John Stevens.
Yeah, that's me. I am a writer and a reviewer and an all-around ne'er-do-well, and you can find me on Twitter, @dogger. And I write some things like really long interviews with Samuel Delaney on SF Signal.
And my other co-host is Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson, JeffPatterson11 on Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. Also do some reviewing, and that's been about it this summer. So,
and this month's special guest, Elisa Krasnstein from Galactic Suburbia, 12th cool. Planet Press, and one of my longer-running friends on Twitter.
Cool, yes. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we are kind of doing a theme this year of publishing, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, because you are involved in 12th Planet Press, and it's a small press. We've talked to some authors. We're going to be talking to some publishers. We had Irene Gallo on, so we had the art perspective. We're hoping to have some artists on later on and authors, so you seem to fit. Plus, you're 12 hours away, so that really fits. So, where to start? Galactic Suburbia. You guys get together, I guess it's twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
But like us, you're kind of spread apart. How did you start the whole thing?
Yeah, well, Australia is really, really big, and we're all pretty much located on the coast. So it is quite hard to see each other in a year. You're lucky if you see your friends at ACON in the year, because, you know, it's like a 5-hour flight for me to get to anywhere. We kind of all knew each other back on Live Journal days, good old Live Journal, and were associated with each other a bit with a couple of other small press ventures. So I used to be a member of the co-op of ASIM, Andromeda Spaceways in Flight magazine,
oh, yes.
Which is where I met Tansy. Mm-hmm. She was there as well. And also the silent producer was also an editor there. And Alex used to read that magazine, and that's where she found out I had a review website back in the very early 2000s, which was about highlighting and honestly critiquing Australian small press as a means to mentor and offer not just a slap on the back, you've done a good job, but to do an honest critique of what we were doing in the hopes that we could improve what we're doing. So Alex came on board and was a reviewer for me for As If, Australian Spec Fic and Focus, as it was called at the time. So that's kind of how we knew each other. But we were massive fans of the podcast, The Sofa Nauts.
Yes.
And we were really, really sad when Tony Smith wound up The Sofa Nauts. We really liked the dynamic. He would have guests on every week, and they would discuss news in fandom and science fiction genre for that week or that fortnight or whatever it was. And we really liked the immediacy of discussing issues. It kind of had the feel of Live Journal, as Live Journal was kind of dying. And Tony C. Smith had offered that if anybody else wanted to take over that podcast, he would be really happy to hand over the reins. And we kind of ummed and ahed about it for a while. And then we realized that, well, if we were going to do that, we would want to do it a bit differently. At the time, there wasn't, I think, a podcast at the time that had all women or more than one or two women on the team. And so we wanted to do something a bit differently. And we realized, well, we may as well just start our own podcast. So in the beginning, it was kind of an homage to Sofa Nauts in the same kind of structure and then it kind of evolved from there.
And you've only actually done, what, a live show, I think, what, four times now? If that,
yeah,
that
I think
many?
It, I think so, yeah. We definitely did one, I think we did our first one at AussieCon, at the WorldCon in Melbourne, and that was actually only in our first year, which was really weird now to think about how many people came to see that. And then maybe two or three other NatCons in 5 years. Yeah, so we're very rarely in the same city at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And how much, I mean, at least for this show, I tend to handle the administrative stuff. Jeff handles the technical stuff. John handles the intellectual stuff. Well, it's true.
He sits in lotus position on the floor and just contemplates the episodes.
You know, I contact the possible guests and try and line up the subjects and or the topics and whatnot. And we do kind of swap a bit of things in terms of planning. But, I mean, you guys seem to have a little more formal approach, or at least a little more thought ahead of time as far as
Yes.
Or is it just the professional?
For us appearing that way. I sometimes have to admit that I am way too overloaded to have my hand in every single pie. So we tend to, Alex kind of is better at making sure we have a Google document that's usually a very rough transcript. Mm-hmm. So we'll just discuss what we think the episode's going to be ahead of time. If we're doing something like the Tiptree spoilerifics, which we're doing now, we've discussed those well in advance because I'm the slowest reader, so I need several months lead time to actually finish the book. And so we'll prepare for those ahead of time. And now that we have our Patreon and we've kind of committed to a quarterly spoilerific, we're kind of having to be a lot more structured in how the whole year is going to look. And then we'll kind of sketch out some ideas about what we think we want to talk about. If something really controversial has happened in fandom, we'll start teasing out what we want to discuss, links maybe. We'll send each other to have read the same material. And then we'll usually have a pre-podcast meeting, maybe 20 minutes, when we just first log on and just discuss it to make sure the discussion goes in the direction that we want. I think in the heat of the moment, you can accidentally say things you didn't mean, or you want to be careful perhaps about how you walk around a subject. So sometimes we'll just decide we're not going to discuss it at all. We might thrash it out and go, no, that's not going to work for us. Or we'll thrash it out and decide actually we don't have anything new to add to the conversation. So we try not to just rehash what everybody else is discussing. We'd be more interested in having a step back and looking at how that discussion's evolving or what it means and stuff. So I guess we do a bit of prep, but it doesn't feel particularly onerous.
That's way too much work. Way, way, way.
Yeah. Yeah, we just get together and say dumb things, and, you know, it's our
I think because I'm a publisher. Yeah, I think because I'm a publisher, I have to be a lot more careful about my image and what I'm saying and doing. I think I have to be a lot more careful about that. And I guess Tansy, as a published author, has to as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you guys have, between you and Jonathan and Gary, you've managed to probably increase my credit card balance in a negative fashion dramatically. So
I don't think we're sorry. I mean, you could have spent that on drugs. So really, we've done you
a
favor.
Yes, you have. But I mean, I think you've had a lot of impact. I mean, do you have any idea of your reach or how many people are downloading, or, you know,
it's really
been nominated for the Hugo.
The Hugo definitely increased our listenership each year. So I think it's been really awesome to be nominated because new people have found us each year, which has been really cool. Mm-hmm. And that increases our reach. And for us, it's about generating new thoughts and ideas and perspectives in listeners. So to have more listeners is really cool. I think we're at the point where some of our really popular episodes have been downloaded 2,000 plus times, but a general reach, I think, is probably between 750 and 1,000 downloads now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Very respectable. Nice. For an obscure podcast.
It feels very odd that that many people would be listening to you. It's very bizarre.
Yep, it sure is. So, now you alluded to the fact that you are also involved in publishing. So how, I mean, it wasn't it, you know, a few years ago, people were saying publishing was dying.
Yeah.
Publishing was dead. And, yep. And you somehow found it within you to start a small press.
And, well, publishing's always been dying, though, to be fair. It's been dying for about 200 to 300 years. So,
yes. Yep.
Yeah. It's a very long, painful, drawn-out death. I don't know. I think my – well, I've ended up really loving publishing. So as long as my books are – selling in numbers that kind of make my cash flow work, I guess I can keep publishing, which is, I think, how publishing works.
Yeah, in theory.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Yeah, I just kind of fell into it, really. And the more I've been involved in it, the more passion I've kind of found for it. So I couldn't imagine not publishing now. I mean, if I've got a spare 5 minutes, that's what I'm doing. And I don't even really think about it. So... I think optimistically, I don't think publishing is dead. I think it's been in flux since I've been a publisher. So I think for me, and being small, you can move quite quickly with trends and with changes to the industry. So it doesn't hit a small press as badly as it does a much bigger, slower moving publisher like, you know, the big ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, 12th Planet, was there a plan? I mean, I thought I had heard somewhere that you named it 12th Planet because you were going to do 12 books.
Oh, but no, I named it 12th Planet because it was in solidarity with Pluto. So at the time that we were forming the press, there was, you know, Pluto's fate was on the line. And they were saying that if Pluto was going to stay as a planet, then they had to add in these other planets. So that would give us 12 planets. And I'm like, that's cool. Keep Pluto as a planet. So that's where 12th Planet came from. So, okay.
So, I mean, you've managed to land some interesting titles, though.
Mm.
For example, let's try this again. Cracklescape,
mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I don't know how many times Jonathan and Gary, to mention some of the competition, have brought that up. And the second one that I want to talk about was Kaleidoscope, which, again, seemed to catch a lot of attention. So you've managed to get some really good stuff going for a relatively small press.
Yeah. I have, but it's been a long process, and it's felt like the way I've considered it is that I have needed to prove myself and do better with each subsequent project. And then as you do better and prove yourself, bigger names have heard of you and are more interested in working with you. So I try to make every project be better than the last one, which is why if you have a look at my press, there's a very long lag between Kaleidoscope, the anthology, and the anthology that I did previously. I didn't think that I had the ability to top that for a while. So I went away and did some other stuff. That's my daughter.
That's okay.
Okay.
If she has an opinion, she can join in too.
Yes. She is leaving the room now. So I've been around since the press started in 2007, but I've been doing some online webzines and stuff before that, and just kind of learning the ropes and learning how to edit and publish and then gaining some credibility. And I think, like, by the time Margot Lanigan actually turned around and finally said, yes, I'll work with you, there was quite a lot of time in between starting and getting to that point where I think I had the credibility for someone like Margot to work with me. So in terms of, you know, that whole overnight sensation, it's, you know, 10 years of working to get to that point.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. John, anything?
No, so far it's fascinating.
I wanted to ask about the WSFA award. that you won, because that was an award I was not even really aware of until I moved down here to the greater DC area, which was a few years after you won that. I'm kind of curious, because I've now suddenly paid attention to the small press landscape in the last few years, and I'm kind of interested. Can you tell us how do they notify you that you're nominated? I mean, how does the small press award landscape work?
How does that even work? As a small press, my philosophy always was that the only way you can ever get the word out is to do things like enter awards, gain some credibility for the quality that you're publishing, but also judges really like to read books, right? So then they've read your books and then they've heard of you. So we've always looked for all the awards that we could nominate our works for. It's quite hard in Australia because postage is expensive, and sometimes awards have registration fees and so on. So a lot of writers are expected to bear the cost of entering their own awards. But it's at 12th Planet, we've always done that, and we've always looked to enter as many competitions as we could. So as soon as the Washington Science Fiction Association opened that award, that was on our radar, because it's a new award that we could apply for. It was an award that was focusing on small press, which seemed really awesome and exciting. So we nominated our work. And the way that they handled their nominations is a publisher can nominate 3 short stories and authors can nominate 1 work of their own. So we'll very carefully work out which stories we're going to nominate. So that was how we ended up being on Washington's landscape. And so that first year when we were nominated, they said, "Oh, do you think you might come?" And I thought, "Yeah, I might come. That sounds like a thing." And I knew it was a pretty big plane journey. But then I also made it to fantasy at the same time. I doubled them because they were 2 weekends apart, and that was just like such an awesome con, Capclave, to hang out at, and met everybody at Washington. So very, very fond of the Washington fandom.
Yeah, I just became I've only been a regular at Capclave for the last 3 years, and I do love it. So
it's a really nice con, and I really love all the fans there. They were really kind to me, and I've stayed friends with a lot of them. So yeah, it was definitely a very fond experience.
Now, I'm not quite sure where this occurred, but at some point you also decided to, hey, I'm running a small business. How about if I get an advanced degree as well?
Yes. Yes, that happened. yes. Actually, that wasn't such a snap decision, but...
Is this related to the genre as well? I can't
yes,
remember.
Yes, completely.
I thought so.
Yeah, so my actual thesis is challenging the core of science fiction, the potential for politicized editing and publishing. That's kind of my thesis title. And I'm looking at how a niche publisher can be successful whilst pushing a political agenda, which is what 12th Planet is and always has been. So let's not pretend it's anything else. So my supervisor is Helen Merrick, who is probably the leading academic in Australia on science fiction and on feminism and science fiction. And she talked me into doing a PhD with her. I'm an environmental engineer by training, and that's what I was doing as my day job. But things are pretty grim for the environment in Australia and also in the public service, which is where I was. And you could start to see that jobs were starting to come on the line. And when we changed prime minister and party for the government, you could see that they were going to start really cutting back. And they've cut back on all kinds of environmental policy, and so it was like I need to jump ship before I don't have a job. So falling into studying full-time was kind of a good leap, because that is what's happened, and I wouldn't have had a job. So it was sort of a bit strategic, but it was also an opportunity to work full-time on my press. So I'm doing creative PhD, which means I have a applied part, which is running my press, running a few projects in my press that I will analyze and critique as my written part of my PhD. So trying a lot of the ideas that I'm exploring about how niche publishers can be successful, and then doing that with a political slant. So like Kaleidoscope was the first book that's sort of officially in my PhD.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting. It's basically like do that thing that you like and then have some thoughts about it and write that up. It's like your dream thing.
You're certainly lucky to have fallen into this.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I don't quite understand how that happened because it's far too perfect.
And what's the is there a deadline or?
Yeah.
Oh,
so then
okay.
I had a baby, and now I'm having another baby, and I'm running a press. So I'm sure I'm going to be quite late, but at the moment I have to hand in, it's September 2017, so at least that doesn't feel too close.
not right now, but
not right now. That'll creep up really, really quickly, I'm aware. Yeah,
pretty astounding. So as I mentioned in our pre-show, I listened to the latest episode of Galactic Suburbia today, and you guys spent, I think it's an hour and 47 minutes.
Yes.
And no culture consumed, darn it.
That's part one. It's part one.
Okay, well, yeah, I was just like, what? Wait. It's ended.
Part two is on Wednesday.
Okay.
And that will be the culture consumed part.
Okay. But you spoke a lot about James Tiptree Jr., Alice Sheldon, and in particular the biography that
Julie Phillips wrote.
Yeah, it's like been 10 years since I've read it. So Julie Phillips wrote about her. And you also are coming out with later this year, or actually, what, is it later this month?
Yeah, it's like next week.
Okay. So we're doing a launch podcast, even better.
Yes, very timely.
Letters from Tiptree, which was a project that I got, was very, I don't think I had bought any of your books before you announced that one. I immediately went out and like bought the subscription just to make sure that I could, and then I pre-ordered it as well. So that's why you saw that big bump from the United States that one day. So what is Letters from Tiptree?
Well, we wanted to do some kind of tribute. It's Alice Sheldon's 100th birthday next Monday, and there didn't seem like there was any whisper going on that anybody was going to be doing some kind of tribute to her. So I wanted to do something, and we decided that because Alice Sheldon and James Tiptree Jr. are quite famous for the letter writing and letter friendships that they developed over the time that they were before Tiptree was outed and then afterwards. So we thought, what better way than to write some letters to either Alice Sheldon, James Tiptree Jr., or Alice's other pen name, Racuna Sheldon, and just sort of talk about how her work or his work had affected writers, editors, fans, readers in science fiction, to just sort of acknowledge that her/his legacy still lives on. So I invited a lot of people to see who would want to contribute. And so people did, which was pretty exciting. And then that sort of ended up being the first section of the book. And then we wanted to kind of complement that. There's a lot in those letters that is really interesting if you have a lot of background. But if you don't have a lot of background, I think it's a great leaping off point to go and delve deeper. And so we thought we might open that door if people were interested. And so the next section, we actually got access to the archives of letters between Ursula K. Le Guin and James Tiptree, and then Joanna Russ and James Tiptree. And so we've sort of got the letters where James outs himself before he's outed to Ursula and Joanna. So we've got that exchange and a little bit of their letter writing back and forward after that, just to have a look at how, you know, you've got a friend that you think is one person and then suddenly find out that they're someone else. So that's the next section. And then we've reprinted other bits and pieces of more academic, but also introductions to two of Tiptree's collections and so on, just to ground the whole thing, a little bit of history, and it's some thoughts around the James Tiptree Award and other aspects of Tiptree's impact on the field. So that's kind of what the books ended up being.
That's quite a coup to get access to the letters.
So once upon a time, you would have to get a travel scholarship, go to a library and sit in the library for 2 weeks, read through all the microfiche or whatever and figure out what you wanted. True. Now you email the librarian in the University of Oregon and she scans it for you and sends you a zip file.
Well, I didn't even know that they had been put into a library.
Le Guin's archived all her correspondence, and then there's quite a few writers who now archive a lot of their correspondence. So that's all there, all of it in graphic detail.
Because part of what you guys were talking today about the books being out of print and hard to find. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether it was, I mean, there are a lot of authors who have died and their estates just basically screw around with the rights.
Yes.
So I wonder if this is a case of things being really muddled. But you're right. I mean, I was shocked. There's no mention, you know, that the anniversary is coming up and it's like,
Yeah. And I think really interestingly, Tiptree Sheldon mentioned in one of her letters, I think to Le Guin, and it's in the book, that once Tiptree was outed, no one was really interested in Tiptree's work anymore. Like she laments that, you know, feminists are still interested in the whole deception, you know, that Tiptree was ineluctably masculine and was obviously a man. Women really liked that whole turning the whole idea of male-female writing on its head, but that Tiptree's effect on the field kind of fell by the wayside after that. And I feel like she was right in that nobody really has pulled together a proper tribute, even of her work, that so little of it is still in print. It's really hard to chase up. I mean, in the book, everybody talks about different pieces of Tiptree's work, and then you want to go away and read that because somebody else has told you why they really like it. That's always such an interesting way to pull you into something, and it's really hard to go away and find it. But yeah, dealing with estate agents is really, really my least favorite part of being a publisher.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the fact that you hadn't seen any evidence of anything coming up for the anniversary, and then you work on this particular volume and word gets out about it. Have you gotten any feedback leading up to its release?
I think people are excited to see what's going to be in the book. I feel like people are interested in it. We've also sort of been partnering with Tachyon, who still has Her Smoke Rose Up Forever in print. You can still buy that. So that's been kind of cool. But estate agents are very, very difficult to work with. A lot of them don't necessarily understand. You know, I'm a small press in Australia, so it's not like one of the big five is coming up to them and offering them a massive deal. So they don't know who you are, and they don't, you know, they may not answer your emails. They may not answer them promptly and stuff. So it is, I can see how people fall out of print. It's sad. It's really sad, but it's a red tape nightmare.
Mm. John, did they still do the Tiptree bake sale up at ReaderCon this year?
No, you know, there was not a Tiptree bake sale this year.
Really?
I think part of it is the changes to the space
that
have been made the last couple years.
That's right, they renovated.
And the hotel just being jerky. That's why we're going to be in Quincy next year. Yay! We'll be on the red line. Yeah, this was the last year ReaderCon is going to be at that terrible hotel. And, so aggravating. So we're going to go to Quincy, which will hopefully be a better venue all around. But yeah, there was no bake sale that I saw this year.
Yeah, there was always Tiptree discussions at ReaderCon. Always. Every year. There was at least one panel on it, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there wasn't, and it's funny. No one really brought up the 100th anniversary either.
Mm. Yeah. We've had, I mean, Stories for Chip is basically a tribute to Chip Delaney.
Between Nicola Griffith and all the Delaney stuff happening, those are really kind of the big things that were getting a lot of attention at ReaderCon this year.
But so many people have had tribute anthologies, even if you don't have the stuff by the author. I mean, Paul Anderson had a tribute. I mean, there's that's like half of what Subterranean Press publishes these days is tribute anthologies or best of, and I'm really surprised.
Well,
come on, publishing world, let's get on it.
But I like the approach that 12th Planet is taking, where they're very specifically blending in Tiptree with all the tributes. I mean, I'm actually reading Stories for Chip right now. I'm about to finish it up. And it's nice. It's nice to read all this stuff. And it really shows influences very well. His influence on other writers. But you don't get the sense of him himself, really. Which is something I'd like to see, like, more people confronting that directly. And it sounds like this is going to be somewhat more like that, where the authors are sort of talking to Tiptree, basically, right?
Yeah.
That was what a lot of the submissions were like? Yeah.
Yeah, they are. So all of those ones are, and they're about either talking about Tiptree's life or about how that life has inspired them. But then that just felt like a very niche perspective. It relies on you to know a lot about Tiptree. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, as a business model, that cuts you off to a wider appeal. So I think any way that you can bring people in to buy more books is always a good philosophy of mine. So, you know, here is a start. This is a very interesting, fascinating, deeply talented person. Why don't you go see what else they've done? Here are some starting points.
So who are some of the contributors that provided letters?
Joe Walton and Rachel Swirsky both wrote poems that are fabulous. We've got Gwyneth Jones, Pat Murphy, Nicola Griffith. Those would be Nissi Shawl is there, Timmy Duchamp. So Tansy and some newer writers. So Tansy and Steph Burgess and Britt Mandello is in there. There's quite a few. There's about 38 letters. And all ranging across a whole range of ways to approach Tiptree, which I think made the book quite interesting and lent itself to looking at a bunch of different things. So, you know, looking at both the deception, in inverted commas, of writing, appearing as a man but being a woman, but then also looking at Sheldon's sexuality and own gender identity as well, and what writing as Tiptree may or may not have meant. So a lot of different ways to have a look at that, but also inspiring other women. So Shauna Maguire talks a lot about how she discovered that Tiptree was a woman, and then that meant that she could write, right? Because there's a woman writing, and so she could write. So quite inspirational how personal Tiptree's experience was to a lot of writers that we now read. So,
but you didn't get Harlan Ellison.
We didn't get Harlan Ellison. The interesting thing is that most men we asked didn't want to play. So it's not that we didn't ask men.
Really?
Yeah.
That was actually a joke based on that.
Yeah.
Commentary from today's episode.
Yeah, and there's some
which
of that
made me laugh very loudly. My dog.
Yeah, those letters are in the book, so you are free to go and have a look at Harlan Ellison's involvement in it. That is all written in the book. Those letters are in the book.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And so on sale later this month.
You can pre-order it now. We are definitely aiming to have the ebook land on Sheldon's birthday. We are working feverishly on that. And as soon as the book is, we actually have a book launch in Perth next Monday. So Tess Williams is another author, and she's, I think, the only Perth contributor. So she and I are going to be doing an interview, and I'm not sure if that's going to be recorded or not. It's with a local radio station. So if that is, I'll put a link somewhere on the internet for that. But yeah, it launches next week to celebrate Alice's 100th birthday, and it'll be pre-ordering now to make sure you can get it, and it'll be out from next week.
So you've got, providing this to the podcast listening audience, I know this already, you've got physical as well as electronic editions.
Yes.
Available. Yes, puppy, we know.
Yeah.
Available at 12th Planet, which we will provide the link of. Are
at
there any
12th
other?
Planet?
Any
yes,
other,
it will. Yeah, it will then be available once it's up. It'll be available from Amazon and probably from Barnes & Noble, hopefully from it'll be in all major online bookstores as well. And Waitlist carries our ebooks if that is your preferred way to buy ebooks. And we do ebooks on our website, Amazon, with the Kindle, etc.
Right. Fantastic. Nice.
Yeah, the two excerpts I read that you had on the website were really interesting.
Oh, and we should have a third one out, I think, as well. Yeah, so Nick Griffiths is... Yep.
Yep, the Science of the books, and then Britt Mandello et Tor.
Yep, and there'll be another one coming out on Strange Horizons, Gwyneth Jones's, not to be missed.
Ooh.
Hers has some naughty words in it. Yeah, no, hers is pretty funny. Gwyneth Jones was there at the time. So it's always nice. We only have a couple of authors who were reading Tiptree as Tiptree and then there for the revelation. And so that gives that other perspective, people who maybe got fooled or, you know, didn't see it coming kind of thing. So she's one of those. So, yeah, a little bit angry, a little bit good. So that should be up, I think, on Monday. I think it comes out in Strange Horizons. So, yeah, there's three available to read. We should probably put the links in the show notes.
Trying to remember now, maybe John, you remember, was it Up the Walls of the World where it like was released at the right on the cusp of the revelation, so the author's picture was kind of
That's
ambiguous.
The novel, isn't it?
Yes,
that
it is.
Came out just after. She was trying to hold it off. She was trying to hold that off till the book, I think, was bought or Pan Mac or whoever it was had it at the time. Yeah, and that came out after. So it actually got published after the revelation, but I think that's possibly one of the last works.
I think she had... I'm trying to remember. I mean, there was at least one or two Sheldons, I think, Screwtape?
Yeah.
Was an analog?
Screwfly Solution?
Right, an analog even, I think. So...
So that, yeah, that was Racuna, wasn't it?
Yes. Yep. Well, that's... I'm looking forward to it, believe me.
Yeah.
If you're sitting here scanning my shelf to see if I can find that, Fred, and
Well, my microphone cord is not long enough to get to the T section of the shelf, so I can't pull it down.
Yeah. And I'll put you down the other end here, so...
So, yeah, really sadly, she says that she couldn't really write as Tiptree after. She just kind of lost her mojo, which is kind of sad.
I mean, at that point, things were getting pretty complicated in her life as well, so...
Yeah.
It's pretty understandable.
Yeah.
Now, do you ever notice the similarities between her and... This is not totally a serious thesis. Between her and Julia Child?
No, I want you to expound.
Or her and Cordwainer Smith.
Ooh.
It's kind of interesting. Well,
that's the Venn diagram is forming. Go ahead.
No, all three worked in intelligence. All three had somewhat secret lives. All three had supportive spouses that encouraged them. I mean, I'm like starting to develop this theory here. Maybe in an alternative universe, all three are the same person.
All three are the same person. Not that we should all go into the Secret Service. I didn't know where we were going.
Well, that's a good career path too. No, but it's kind of weirdly similar in many ways. All three of them,
right?
I think that when you read the biography, you know, Alice Sheldon was such an interesting person. The kinds of life experiences that she had that then got fueled into her writing, You know, I've lived such a boring life. Obviously, I can't be a great writer. I have nothing to say. Well, I'm sure that's not true, but yeah.
The thing that's always struck me about Tiptree, though, is since probably the early 80s, I've noted at least three pretty sizable peaks in interest in her work. What mm-hmm. spurred them, I don't know, but I've seen, you know, aside from things like panels at ReaderCon and panels at other conventions, she was one of those writers who, and I don't want to actually draw a comparison to Heinlein, but the interest in her sort of follows the same route. Heinlein is one of those people who, you know, interest spikes when there's a new movie, except for Predestination. Nobody gave a shit, but it interest tends to ebb and flow. And for a variety of reasons. And I've sort of noticed the same thing with Tiptree. I remember there was a ReaderCon panel that I went to that James Morrow talked at length about, how frustrating it was that Tiptree had been, you know, fairly popular for such a long time, and then suddenly was one of those authors who got crushed under the wheels of cyberpunk and had to be wait to be rediscovered, you know, years later. And I think it's odd that there is that entire echelon of authors that sort of happens to. But Tiptree's always been unique to me in that respect, that it always comes back, and the admiration almost always takes the exact same form too. It's not a flighty, fashionable popularity when it does manage to roll up.
That's really interesting. I mean, I'm sort of wondering like why. I guess you could pick the peaks to, you know, maybe her death, and then the Tiptree Award, and then, you know, you can see why people would draw some, and then that comes back to the gatekeepers, right? Because you can't hear about somebody that you don't know about. And I find it really interesting when I play the drinking game to listen to who people will list in any list when you have to come up with a science fiction author list. I played, you know, who are you going to mention, right? You know, which is now you're all like, oh my God, don't mention any other names because she's judging me. But, you know, it's really interesting how often nobody lists Tiptree as one of the greats. And yet when you read the kind of feedback that people were writing about that work at the time, it was like, you know, this is the all-time best stuff ever written, and now we've completely forgotten about it. And so for me and for Galactic Suburbia, because we have positioned ourselves as gatekeepers and deliberately as a different kind of gatekeeper, for us there's a responsibility to keep pushing women who you've forgotten and you shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, like, that's a very deliberate mission statement. And I think it's something that when you are a gatekeeper, I think it's nice to be self-aware about what you're keeping the gates to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we've done that on this podcast. I mean, we did a whole episode on Charles Sheffield, who you can barely ever find in print anymore. And I've mentioned people like Arthur Byron Cover and stuff like that, who just hit with such a major splash and then sort of became footnotes. And I doubt we're...
Which is quite funny when you think of, when you put that kind of stuff, because, you know, like I'm in 2015, just like you're in 2015. And so there's a lot of conversations going on in 2015. And I've been having that as the background to all this kind of intensive reading that I'm doing. And reading, you know, the equivalent of blog posts, but they're letters to each other kind of thing. And reading highly intelligent, thoughtful people writing, which is always the most humbling experience. And sort of, you know, it even they get forgotten. Even great geniuses get forgotten. And so, you know, it's like nobody cares really about the Hugo ballot in 2015 in 2035.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to care. We're all going to be forgotten.
No, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. No, it's true, and it's. But I kind of wonder if her unmasking and then her sort of dropping off after that had an impact on how she was considered in the field.
I think personally, I think it did.
I'm sorry?
I think it did. I think that's very much what happens.
Yeah, and it's funny to tie this back to the book. I was thinking about what Nicola Griffith was writing about, this whole idea of she was using that identity to sort of to be as a cover to give herself some distance so she could avoid some of the scrutiny that she would get as sort of a woman writer in the period she was writing in. I mean, Nicola even writes, "It's my belief that James Tiptree Jr., three words, gave you cover, a way to be free in the world without risking a particular scrutiny." And it's interesting
and that particular scrutiny, could be many different things as well.
Right.
About her life. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think unfortunately that did have an impact, which is too bad because she is one of the greats of science fiction. She just wrote incredible stuff that was often very groundbreaking, and it was generally fearless. I mean, especially with their short stories, a lot of them really packed a huge amount of punch that you didn't see as often in a lot of the other fiction of the time. And you'd think someone like that should be celebrated because she sort of is one of those people who proves that a lot of the things people say about the good old days were really not correct.
Yes.
It was a much more rich and complicated period. And she was a part of that.
And that A, women have always been here, and B, that we've always been discussing the kind of issues that we're still discussing in 2015. They're not new. It's not some brand new chocolate wrapper. It's not new.
I think she's a great author to talk about for that reason as well. It's just the power of her work.
Well, I think it's really interesting you say that she packs a punch, and I want to say that she writes with fury and with great anger, but actually she writes quite dispassionately. And yet that comes through in the pace and cutting.
The style is not furious.
No.
But the things she's talking about just will infuriate you and sadden you. And
she delivers no mercy. As a reader. There's no mercy.
No, there's none.
There's no happy ending here either. You know, it's all, it's just like, yeah, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear. Which has been great to just be really immersed in it, and hopefully we're talking about it and you're talking about it, and we'll have another peek, and that's
right.
You know, it's yeah.
Well, when I the last thing I read of hers most recently was in Sisters of the Revolution that the Vandermeers edited, and that's the story where men just start inexplicably doing incredible violence, and it's like, first of all, it's hard just when you start reading it to see how the story's going to work. But that combination of sort of the deadpan delivery with that sort of barely contained, you know, anger is really what makes the story not just stick in your head, but it really makes you stop and think about a lot of things.
Which is really interesting because I just finished Houston, Do You Read last night because we're discussing that on the next Galactic Suburbia, and that has exactly the same theme in it. And so that struck me completely, kind of partly her point in that story too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know if that's like upliftingly feminist either, because, you know, that's like, what, 40 years ago, and we're still exactly in the same kind of place.
Right.
But then again, she delivers no hope, so, you know, there's no hope. We're doomed.
Well, she seems to be saying that, you know, until everybody's ready to change, things are not going to change. Until you can get everyone to see what needs to change, and get them to participate on some level with it, it's just not going to happen. It's going to always be frustrating and compromising and incomplete and, you know?
Yeah, because I'm just thinking about the whole, you know, sad puppies thing. And it's like, well, most of us are on this particular path, and then the few people who aren't can actually do the most destruction, which is kind of her point.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
You know, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm actually thinking about what you just said about her role in the SF landscape at that time. And the thing that just struck me, I talked a few months ago, I had just reread all the Women of Wonder series. I've been on a bit of a Pamela Sargent kick. And I was thinking about the fact that other people who were writing around the same period, Aronson and Tuttle and stuff like that, were doing really potent stories, but they really weren't bringing in downers like she was. and that's by no means I don't know what it's an observation. I'm not drawing a judgment based on it, but I just found it odd. It triggered that nerve when you said that about her, because I'm thinking about, you know, me being, you know, 12 to 16 years old and the issues of SNF SF that I was picking up at the time, and how there were specific names that were showing up on a regular basis, and and how I was noting the ones that were telling stories that were either A, exciting, B, had a happy ending, or C, were bleak and dispassionate. And I now want to go back and start revisiting this.
Yeah, and it's interesting to do it with distance and with age, though, too, isn't it? Because when you realize that Tiptree was probably a generation older than most of those women writers. She's coming to it with a completely different perspective. Firstly, because her own feminist experience is going to be a generation earlier and completely different. But also, she's lived that much longer. And I just think you just get that much more jaded.
That's true.
I kind of think about that essay that we wrote, that we read for the other spoilerific by Ursula Le Guin, about how the best representative for Earth would be the crone old grandmother. That's the person you should send out to represent Earth, because that's the person who has the most knowledge and wisdom about humanity. And I'm not sure that that person is going to be all like, we're awesome. Because you've seen too much, you know?
Right.
And so the other thing I was thinking about was last year at Cap Play, there was a panel on Zena Henderson, and it had probably been about 10 years since I had read the people's stories, and I'm sitting there at the panel, and everybody's takeaway from the stories was just so different from mine. And I went back and reread a whole chunk of it, and I was like, well, I couldn't even possibly interpret this story the way a lot of those people did. So it's one of those things that, personal interpretations go a long way in the impact that authors make. And the fact that Tiptree, for me primarily, and like I said, this is, you know, early teens, me really starting to get voracious with the magazines that were coming out at the time, was a name that was just so instantly recognizable when I saw it. So as I got later into my teens and really started diving into SF history and really started seeing, you know, if you view the literature as a topographic map, you actually saw where, you know, the impact that she made and how it brought in not only how it opened so many doors, but also how it, for the most part, how it had a pretty significant influence too. I mean, hell, I read The White Plague by Frank Herbert, and I go, my God, he's writing a Tiptree book here. And I think that was a fairly widespread consensus of opinion around that time too, but I might be mistaken. So,
no, I think you're right, and I think it's interesting that people who mark the roadmap for, was it Harlan Ellison in that quote I think that Tansy read out, that if a new wave of science fiction is one person, you're the person, is what he said to Tiptree, and yet we never forget William Gibson started the new wave, you know, like we don't, there are other people who we don't forget as being landmark, and yet very rarely will people actually mention Tiptree unless they have to quickly rush and name some great female writers, and they've already said Ursula Le Guin, then they have to go rubbling around at the bottom of the bag to see who else's names come up. It's a game I play, and once you start watching people, it's really hard not to see it.
I agree with you there, but I think a lot of that also, and once again, I'm not trying to play devil's advocate here. I think a lot of that has to do with continuity of being in print as well.
I agree, because how are you going to hear about somebody that you can't find their book on the shelf? It's a very valid point.
History is written by those with shelf life. And that's why certain names are always going to, that's why you can't find any David Chow books, who's probably one of my favorite horror writers, because there's nothing but Dean Koontz and Stephen King on the shelves. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now that we've all learned we should not go drinking with Elisa, shall we move on to Culture Consumed? Or we will end up with an episode worthy of either Galactic Suburbia or Good Street in length.
Sure.
Who wants to go first?
I'm really short. I'll go first.
Okay. I was gonna say, since I'm hosting, I don't have to go first.
That's right. You can make someone else go. Mine's pretty short because the 2 weeks after the last podcast, I was busy being ill and doing the Delaney interview.
You still have the bags, and you're gonna wear those bags under your eyes like medals for the rest of your life. Badges of honor.
It really actually impacted my reading. I've got a couple things almost done, but the only thing I've read all the way through is ABC, the new omnibus of his first three novels, which is good. And I enjoyed it, but it was a very odd experience, because not only is this his first work, but especially in the first two, in Jewels of Aftor and Ballad of Beta 2, I think he uses sort of more tried and true science fiction elements than he did in a lot of his later work. So it's really interesting to see him doing the kind of things he does stylistically with characters and such, but set in much more recognizable science fictional contexts. So the Jewels of Aptor is sort of like it's basically like a quest story. The heroes have to find a MacGuffin and bring it back to save, their city. But the great thing about that is it shows off both his really good command of character, but also the way that he can invert expectations, because throughout the entire book, nothing goes right, ever. Nothing goes right, absolutely nothing. You know, at the end of the book, you're like, well, it sounds like things turned out okay, but did they? We have to read the next chapter to really know. And the Ballad of Beta 2, I love just because of the way it's sort of a puzzle box. Although it kind of depends on the protagonist being an ass quite often. But really, it's really a fun read. And I think they Fly at Siron is really, for me, kind of the first really, really good thing he does, where he really tries to not just play with ideas, but actually construct something distinctive and different out of them. So it was a lot of fun to read, and I'm working on a review of that for SF Signal. But I'm also reading a bunch of stuff at the same time, because I do that. I'm reading Zensho's Sorcerer of the Crown, and I'm reading Gene Wolfe's A Borrowed Man, and I'm just a couple of stories away from finishing stories for Chip. So far, all of those are interesting. I'm having a little trouble getting into Borrowed Man, which is sometimes a problem I have with Wolf. But the other two, like the stories for Chip, is just really great, because having talked about, Tiptree's tribute, this is a very different kind of tribute. This is writers showing us quite often what his influence was by writing fiction and talking about his impact on their life, but also his impact on their work. And that's, pretty much what I've read in the last couple of weeks, basically.
Not too shabby.
Yeah, not bad at all.
Okay, who wants to go next?
I'll take it. All right. First of all, I also just reread Aptor, and that book is exhausting. So I found myself physically wiped out after reading it, and I probably hadn't read it in maybe 12 years or so. So, so I'm taking a break before I do the other two. A couple comics got to mention. Number one, Phonogram is back by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. The story's called The Immaterial Girl. First issue came out, and it was a riot. And McKelvey's art is always just so utterly clean and uncluttered, even though the compositions can be very cluttered. Really excited that it's back. I may actually wait until all the issues are out before I read the rest of them. First issue of Paul Cornell's Doctor Who, The Four Doctors came out. And very interesting. It's basically the last three doctors plus the War Doctor, who's only really seen in a prologue. Interesting thing about the story is that it's basically all about the sidekicks trying to prevent a inter-doctor crossover. And it was done very well. Capaldi interactions with the previous two doctors are written very well. He's really nailed their voices, as Cornell tends to do. I'm still reading the Secret Wars books and the various tie-ins, but the one title that I was not aware of when I spoke at length about it last month, which I am now caught up on, is Garth Ennis and Russ Braun are doing a book called Where Monsters Dwell, which has to do with this incredibly obnoxious cargo pilot during World War One who ends up trapped on an island with dinosaurs with a female passenger who is obviously more than she appears to be, and they end up trapped with this crazy Amazon tribe, and it is possibly the rudest book I've ever seen Marvel print. It truly is. This is Vertigo levels of rudeness coming from Garth Ennis on this book, and I'm loving it. There is a new adaptation of Richard Matheson's Shrinking Man that's coming out right now. I forget who the publisher is. I think it's IDW, by Ted Adams and Mark Torres, which is really good. Two issues are out, and it's really, really, it's better than I thought it could be. The third issue of Alan Moore's Providence is out, and the creepiness continues to ratchet up. And yeah, this is going to be messy by the time we get to issue 12, I can tell. I've actually watched some television. I watched all of Sense8, the Wachowski Straczynski series, the first episode of that, which I think was 12 episodes, was it 10 or 12, I forget. I think it was 12. It could have been 10. It could have been tightened up quite a bit. But for the most part, as TVSF goes, I thought it did a pretty good job, especially given the colossal cast that it brought in. And I really, really liked it. There are a couple of sort of major practical points that I kind of got angry about with this premise of people being able to communicate with seven other people around the world, such as the fact that if you know there's a plot against you, you might want to tell the other people that there's a plot against you. That's sort of the whole point of having a superpower. And also, if you're a hacker on the run, and you know that all these people are coming to try and get you, please try to act and take precautions as if people are coming and trying to get you. There was way too much, oh, we'll be safe here, let's have sex. And that really needed to be, I mean, trust me, I would love to, you know, I'd love to go down on Freema Agamemnon, but if I'm being chased by government agents, I think I'm going to put it off for a little bit, you know, especially when there's techno music playing in the background. And I got to talk about Mr. Robot, because there's two episodes of Mr. Robot left as we're recording this. And I have to reserve judgment until the end, because the series has come right up to the point where I go, okay, this can be really good or this can really suck, depending on if they stick the ending of this particular story. But it has been renewed for season two. So I'm hoping that we'll at least get a little bit of closure by the time we get to the 10th episode. Have to mention in Strawn's Best Of, a story I had not read last year was Peter Watts' Collateral. Wow, that was really good. Not a story I had read before and kind of blew my socks off. I read it in a waiting room and wanted to go home and write about it immediately. I read about half of Italo Calvino's The Complete Cosma Comics, which I had never read before. And I don't know what I just read. I really don't. I'm going to try to go through the second half of it. I kind of sort of see what he's trying to do, but I don't know if he actually does it. I've never felt this ambiguous about Calvino in my life. And it's very confusing. My head hurts. Ted Kosmatka's The Flicker Men came out, and I read that, and I really, really liked it. And it's basically the book that I wanted David Walton's Superposition to be. So it was kind of nice to have that roll up. And continuing my Pamela Sargent kick from the last couple of months, I read Puss in DC, her new short story collection that is out. And that sent me back to read The Mountain Cage and other stories from 2002 that came out. So 13 years ago. I just sort of completely immersed myself in her short stuff for a while. And yeah, this is like the third time this has happened since we've started this podcast where I've gone back and started reading an author who I read pretty regularly in my life and rediscovered new layers. And reading Sargent short stuff really did that to me. And I was very, very pleased because after I read Alien Child, I said, you know, I remember enjoying her shorts. I'd like to make sure that they hold up over time. And they do. They exceeded my remembrances and expectations both. So very happy with that. And that's all I got.
Okay. Want me to go first, Lisa, or?
Sure.
Okay.
Who wants to follow that?
Well, I don't remember if this was publicly available during a last episode, but I just watched John's appearance at ReaderCon on the Dahlgren panel. And so
I think that was on C-SPAN.
It was certainly long enough to be on C-SPAN. So we will include a link for that. I'm not sure if there are any other video available for ReaderCon, like maybe a panel where Chip Delaney actually shows up, but one can hope.
The same person who has that up actually has all the ReaderCon panels up.
Okay, good.
He made that one private for a few weeks for reasons I never discovered, but but everything's up. Like my talk is up, and all looks like pretty much all the tracks for panels are up. I don't think readings made it on, but panels I'm pretty sure are all there.
Okay. And the year in shorts stands at 670. 670 short works, not short stories, short works. And the year in books stands at 100 even right now. Yay me. Just a couple of highlights. I read, since we've discussed him in the past, Absolute Metropolitan, the first volume by Warren Ellis and Company. Yeah. And I think, Jeff, we mentioned I gave up on Sandman Overture on the tablet because that so many double pages, and even on a 10-inch tablet, I couldn't get the full impact. And the contrast that with Absolute Metropolitan, this covers the first 18 issues of Transmetropolitan and the one issue called I Think I Hate It Here.
Yep.
And there was, I forget which story it was, maybe about halfway through, there was just an issue where I just stopped and stared at every page. It was just so beautiful compared to previous readings in paper and previous readings on the tablet. So every now and then you do need to see something live and direct.
Yeah.
Sandman,
I'm waiting for the trade. The last issue broke me trying to read that on the tablet.
I'm just going to have to.
Too many fonts, too many funky backgrounds. It's gorgeous to look at, but I said, that's it. I'm waiting till it's all out. So,
on the intellectual end of things, I read Mr. Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum for the first time in a long time. and that wasn't enjoyable because it's just a giant conspiracy theory, and Dan Brown can go suck it. You know, this is how it should be done. Comics-wise, I've read a lot of stuff. My daughter's read a lot more stuff, so I'm not even going to go into that. Other than maybe I've been reading a lot of the Hellboys and BPRDs and Abe Sapiens and lots of good stuff there, especially like Hellboy's Midnight Circus really had a nice Ray Bradbury feel to it.
Yeah, that was a good one.
I just finished rereading The Human Division by John Scalzi because the new installment in that part of his Old Man's War series is out. And, you know, I think I like the Human Division better than the John Perry stories, which is where the whole series started. And a few things in progress. I bought a book called 80 Days, Nellie Bly and Elizabeth Bislin's History Making Race Around the World, thinking that it was another book called Nellie Bly Around the World in 72 Days and Other Writings. So it's an interesting story. I mean, she went around the world because it seemed to be the thing. They wanted to like recreate Jules Verne. And the weird thing is that Elizabeth Bislin was another female reporter whose boss basically said, hey, you should do this too. And she's like, wait, what? And they basically tossed her on a steamship almost immediately without any preparation. So it's just this really weird story. The other one, Nellie Bly Around the World, is actually her own writings, which is the one that I thought I was buying, but I didn't. And then I just got Gertrude Bell, A Woman in Arabia. And people that know me for a long time know that I've used people like T.E. Lawrence as my profile picture for years. I mean, you can think of Gertrude Bell as doing a lot of it in the same area of the world where we're still involved, rightly or wrongly, weirdly or not. So a really interesting historical piece because I'm trying to read a lot more nonfiction this year. And I'm semi-succeeding. Too many comics, not enough nonfiction. So that's it for me.
Hey, you know, one thing I discovered, I have not read these yet, but I was unaware they existed. Apparently there was a series of Boba Fett novels that people like Terry Bisson and Elizabeth Hand wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I was unaware of this. So I will be diving into those at some point in the near future. So.
Okay. Time to face the music, Alyssa.
That leaves me.
I know it's mostly going to be Tiptree. That's okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been engrossed in the bio, so The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon, James Fitcher Jr., The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon by Julie Phillips, and also the short story collection Her Smoke Grows Up Forever, James Tiptree Jr., and we'll be discussing a couple of those stories in depth this week for the next Galactic Suburbia episode. So Houston, do you read? And I always get this title really wrong. Your Faces, Oh My Sisters, Your Faces, Field of Light. So those two I've been completely immersed in. The other totally cool culture I consumed was I went this week and saw Chris Hadfield, Colonel Chris Hadfield, who headed up the International Space Station talk. Mm-hmm. He's touring Australia at the moment, and we got to see his live talk. And it was the first time in a really, really long time that I genuinely might have had sense of wonder feels. I really hate that word, but I had them. He was just unbelievably inspiring, both the person that he is and what it takes to become an astronaut and what it takes to become a Canadian astronaut, because they don't have a space program, obviously, at the point at which he decided he wanted to be an astronaut. And then also his perspective of the world. Like, you know, you're watching someone who has actually been in space, which to me, I just wanted to, like, see that in person. But the sense of perspective, actually having left Earth and rotated around it and looked at Earth, was just such a optimistic, maybe idealistic view of humanity and what we're doing. It was really unbelievably refreshing. And just his whole, yes, we're going to go to Mars, this is totally going to be a thing, and justifying it and stuff. But just a unbelievably brilliant mind and a fantastic communicator. So that was totally uplifting. And he sang two songs, and we got to see all his bunch of his pictures that he took from space. And because he was in Perth and talking to a Perth crowd, we got to see all his Perth pictures from space, and he was like, yes, I do know where Perth is because it's the first city that rises after Africa, and it's like, yeah. So that was really nice. So I got to do that. That was my consuming of culture. Not much, but it was pretty cool.
I read his, mm-hmm. or rather listened to his book on audio, and he reads it himself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so wow.
I'm not sure if that's available. It's Audible is where I got it.
It should be. Yeah.
I recommend that one.
I grabbed the biography myself. I already had that, but he has a lovely voice, and he's just, yeah, he was a really good speaker. It was really nice to see someone really polished as a communicator as well. So, yeah.
Yep.
Hey.
Yeah, really.
Where was Houston do your read? Where was that first published?
Well, let me call up the Internet Science Fiction Database and we'll find out.
I'm just sitting here having this flashback of the first time I saw that title on a TOC, and I remember reading it immediately. And I'm just trying to think of where it was.
I mean, I'm thinking that I first read it in a Best of anthology. And why are you telling me there's no person named Tiptree here? Internet SF Database. Okay, short stories, Houston, scrolling, and of course, it's 1976.
Wait, that late? I thought it was earlier.
It won the 77 Hugo.
It's weird as how it's arranged. It's not... Oh, come on, guys. 1977 Annual World's Best SF by Don Wilhelm.
That had to be where I read it then. Okay.
Not telling me where the first appearance is, weirdly enough. I used to get those
best ofs all the time back then, and I'm at another pen into 76 for me then, because 76 is always the year that everything broke in my head when it came to SF and what you could do with it. And then the following 2 years were Star Wars and Heavy Metal magazines. So
it was originally published in the 76 in the Women Only Science Fiction.
Right.
And I'm waiting for it to...
Aurora, Beyond Equality.
Oh!
Susan, Janice Anderson, and Vonda and McIntyre.
McIntyre?
Yeah.
I do have that, but I must have read it in Year's Best because I didn't have that then. I do have Aurora, though.
And in fact, there is Your Faces, Oh My Sisters, Your Faces Are... Yeah. Now I just screwed it up.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Yes. Marge Piercy. Oh, my goodness. Marge Piercy. Holy moly.
Now I'm remembering how many authors I turned on to just because of those Year's Best.
Yeah, I think I read that Marge Piercy, I think, was later expanded into a novel? Woman on the Edge of Time?
Yeah.
That sounds right.
Senior seminar in women's studies, senior year of college, if I remember correctly. One of our selections.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. Memories.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've kept you more than long enough. Your dog and your daughter have both been very patient with us. So any final thoughts, anybody?
I just wanted to thank you for having me on. I had a really good time.
Oh,
really?
No, it was great. We had a great conversation.
Yep. Went places I wasn't expecting we were going to go to.
Yep,
I didn't think we were going to talk about Tiptree really at all until today's episode. So I'm glad I listened. So, John, any final thoughts?
No, I'm good.
Jeff?
I think we have exhausted it.
Okay. Next month, another special guest. And before we started, we were discussing some other possible plans. So... watch the Twitter feed. I was kind of joking that we were going to take up knitting because there appears to be a tradition on another podcast where everyone knits. But I don't have the manual dexterity. But who knows?
I totally knitted through your podcast.
Maybe the Borges podcast will actually occur. Who the heck knows, guys and gals? You've certainly surprised us with your interest. So we'll see. So thanks to our special guest. Thanks for putting up with us early in the morning.
Oh,
and thanks to the other members of your household for letting you go for a while.
Yes, I will tell them.
So good night, everyone.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Take care.
Thanks.